This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
G-I-R-L-S-C-A-M-P, it's Girls Camp.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Girls Camp podcast. I'm your host, Haley Rawl, and I'm joined today by the wonderful Samantha Shelley.
Hi, Haley Rawl.
Hi. Of Zelf on the Shelf.
Yeah.
I'm so excited we're finally doing this. We were just joking, but we've been trying to do this for half a year, it feels like.
Yes, it is impossible to schedule.
It's so hard. And then I was watching on this couch, I was watching the 2020 episode on Ruby Frankie, and I saw you in it, which I didn't know you were in it. I was like, oh my gosh, Bentley, we've been trying to get together and do some podcasting. And I texted you and said, can you come over in 2 days? And you were able to.
And I could. Do you look at the camera much when you record?
Don't actually.
Okay, we're not breaking the fourth wall.
We're not breaking the fourth. Yeah, and we're pretending. Go away, you guys. Having a little chat.
Yeah.
So you and I are going to be talking about the Ruby Frankie thing. And I was just telling you this. I have steered a little bit clear, I feel like, generally on Girls Camp, of getting into anything that, I don't know, news-y, like current events things, mainly because I don't feel resourced enough to like have the facts straight. And because I think there are so many other people in the space that are doing such good coverage.
Yeah,
that I just don't feel like I need to like provide that aspect of things. However, I'm really excited to talk about this with you and talk about the themes of this case, why it is grabbing so much attention for non-Mormons and ex-Mormons and Mormons and just basically the Mormonism of it all. So we will do a brief overview of the Ruby Frankie stuff and then dive into some of those themes. But before we do Perfect. So, could you give a little introduction of yourself, who you are, what you do, and a brief little background of where you fit in with the Mormonism stuff?
Yes. So I'm Sam. I'm 31. I joined the church in England when I was 17. Went to BYU, Idaho, did an internship for Deseret Book after college. Had a massive faith crisis 1 month into my eternal marriage when I was 22.
Oof.
And was like, none of this is true. I'm in a cult. Since then, have been doing Zelf on the Shelf with my best friend Tana on YouTube. And yeah.
I also have a best friend, Tanner, which is cute. And we're also both Geminis, we discovered.
It's so weird, right?
Yeah, it's weird.
It's weird how many Geminis I meet.
Really?
Me and Tanner did this photo shoot recently where we were both devils and both of the makeup artists were Geminis.
Really?
Just all four of us. And the photographer. There were five Geminis. There's something going on.
There's something going on. Yeah. I feel like whenever, not all the time, I'm friends with plenty of people who are not Geminis. But oftentimes I'll jive with
someone. I have non-Gemini friends, you guys.
Don't get me wrong. But I'll be jiving with someone and then we discover, oh, you're a Gemini. And I'm like,
something in there.
I know. I don't know much about it, but I do feel like there's something with Geminis.
And you have twins. And my dad is a twin. That's enough. We can stop talking about this.
The twins too.
Yeah.
I know. I'm determined. Well, Bentley wants to get it anyway, but he wants to get a little twin tattoo, like two little cherubs, because I'm a Gemini and for the twins too, which I think is really fun. Okay, thank you so much for that intro. I wish we could talk so much about your story, but I feel like people can go to your channel.
Yeah, there's enough of that.
I'm sure there's so much good content that digs more into your story. So let's dive into the Ruby Frankie thing.
Yeah.
Let's give a quick overview in case anybody doesn't know, which I feel like probably most people at this point know, about Ruby Frankie, eight passengers, the whole situation. This all was a pretty big news story. When was it? Maybe September of last year, when things were coming to light, when her son,
I think he goes by R, doesn't
R,
he?
R, yes. Think,
yeah.
Yes. Her son escaped from where he was staying at Ruby's friend, kind of
therapist.
Co-worker, therapist.
Yeah.
her kids were staying, two of her younger kids were staying at Jody Hildebrand's house. Her son escaped and was in terrible shape, emaciated, clearly abused, and it brought all of this abuse to light. Starting at the beginning, Ruby Frankie and her family had a YouTube channel called Eight Passengers that gained popularity fairly quickly. And it was a pretty typical, I would say, Mormon vlogger family channel. Mm-hmm. However, it started to get pretty controversial pretty quickly because of the discipline tactics that Ruby was using on her children.
I feel like the one that has been prominent in all the coverage is when Ruby said to, I think it was her daughter, if you don't do what I say, I'm going to take your beloved teddy and cut his head off. I don't know. I just know for me as a kid, like how beloved your stuffed animals are to you. Like they have personhood. They are actual deep family connections to you. So things like that, yeah, that were popping up in the YouTube videos that she's obviously feeling fine showing. I mean, that's, you know, raising like rightfully so massive red flags for people because it's like, this is what she's like fine showing. This is what feels kind of just fun and light to her.
Yes. This is things she is intentionally broadcasting to millions of people.
Ugh.
Just a lot of really, I would say pretty obviously, I highly doubt many people were thinking, oh, this is great discipline. I think it's pretty objectively problematic. And it seems like, according to what I've read and what I've heard, that people started raising concerns on her channel as well. But she seemed undeterred, kind of continued with those tactics. Mm. And then Jody Hildebrand comes into the picture. Can you give us a little backstory on the Jody thing? Which I know there's so much there too.
I know, yeah. I'll just try my best. So she was a therapist. She worked with, I don't know if she worked for LDS Family Services, but she was very much a Mormon therapist. Like bishops were recommending couples to her. And I think specifically men who had, you know, like sexual addictions, although she was able to sort of co-opt Mormonism's terror around sexual addictions to sort of like manufacture sexual addictions in people's minds. But yeah, so all these people are getting recommended to Jody by their Mormon bishops. She, as far as we know, had like ties with high up Mormon leaders. So she's a prominent person in the community. Like she's respected, she's successful. I mean, by the time Ruby met her, she, I think, already lived in like that massive multi-million dollar house.
That house was huge. That was one of the things that struck me about the documentary was how gigantic that house was. And fairly empty. It, the whole thing was bizarre. But yeah, probably making good money doing her therapy and being endorsed, whether explicitly or implicitly, by the LDS community.
And don't you think kind of strange that she had that level of power in the system because she was a divorced woman? I think she was married for only a couple years or a few years, had a kid, then gets divorced and has been divorced ever since. And yet she's still seen as this person to look to on marriage issues, which doesn't seem that common.
It seems really interesting. A theme that I want to explore more with you that I find super interesting about this case, and I think any case where there's a woman cult leader, is the feminism of it all, but in this really perverse way, right? And I find
she's making the patriarchy work for her.
Exactly. And I find it really fascinating that she was endorsed so heavily by the LDS community because she was pretty clearly very much against men. People would come into her therapy practice and she quite literally demonized any man who had ever looked at porn, for example, and pinned them with sex addiction, or even said they were pedophiles, things like that, which I find interesting in such a patriarchal system like the LDS Church, that she was kind of finding this way to work against that while still maintaining pretty good graces in that community. I think that's an interesting thing. Same with Ruby and the influencer, moneymaker, entrepreneurship of it all. That's something that I've been reflecting a lot on, is how these women in a traditionally patriarchal structure kind of create this thing that is, I mean, I wouldn't say female focused about female empowerment or anything, but the women are taking charge in this way that unfortunately turned out very, very horrific. But still, you know,
it's weird because the whole, like a lot of LDS people are terrified of feminism or, you know, liberal feminism, whatever, because they're like, it's man-hating. But then Jody seems quite openly man-hating. throughout her career and, you know, has this like pattern of systematically turning women against their men.
Yeah.
But that's fine, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
If you can invoke porn addiction, you can get away with a lot in Mormonism.
Absolutely. Jody Hildebrandt comes into the picture and becomes pretty closely connected with Ruby. Ruby seems to kind of become like a right-hand woman.
Mm.
They create a group called Connections.
But interesting that Jody's a... because she did get her license revoked for sharing personal information about Adam Paul Steed with BYU. But I think she, at this point, was a therapist still. Like, I don't think she ever got her license permanently taken away. But it's interesting that she chose to pursue the coaching route because it's an unregulated industry.
Yeah. Yes. Makes a lot of sense. Adam Steed talks a lot about how much he suffered at the hands of Jody specifically.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's full on psychopath behavior from Jody. You know, it's not the thing they were able to pin her on to take her license away, like her telling BYU about his sexual sins. Like, that was the least of it. That was just what they could kind of get her on.
Yeah.
But she was systematically turning his wife against him, fabricating this entire narrative that he was a pedophile when he had been a victim of pedophilia growing up. So it's like extra horrific.
Yeah. So terrible. Jody, I mean, we could talk forever about all of that as well. What ended up happening is Jody and Ruby were primarily taking care of the two younger children, R and E. And the father had been taken kind of out of the picture at this point, Ruby's husband.
As per Jody's kind of standard approach.
Yes, to kind of separate the family. This young boy, R, escaped, went to a neighbor's home, and was in absolutely horrific shape, emaciated, had suffered. You know, you could tell he had been tied up, had just been abused. It was fairly clear. Something that really struck me watching the documentary, the 2020 episode, was just, I mean, child abuse is obviously horrific, but how horrific this really was. Many of the EMT, the sheriff, police people said on this documentary, we had to excuse ourselves to go cry. And I mean, you can only imagine what kinds of things these people see and just how deeply you could tell it affected anybody who saw these children in that state. They went to Jody's house. They got E out of the home, who had also been abused. And both Jody and Ruby were put in jail. The sentencing just happened in February for Jody and Ruby. And they pleaded guilty, I think, to 4 out of 6 counts that they were originally charged with of aggravated child abuse.
Did you watch Jody and Ruby's like court statements at their hearing?
I watched Ruby's.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what you think. Maybe it's too early in the episode to discuss this.
Yes, but no, let's jump right there. I saw Ruby's on TikTok, I believe. And she apologized, right? Her whole thing was like apologizing for what she had done. I just think of those kids and I almost find it in some ways worse. I mean, obviously she should apologize, but to even have to listen to your mother who treated you so horrifically say they're sorry, it just so doesn't even come close.
Yeah.
That I almost feel like watching her apologize, and I believe she was crying and remorseful or pretending to be remorseful, I just thought that almost makes it worse to me because it's just like, I can't imagine being her child one day and watching that and feeling like my mother did all these unspeakable, horrific things and now just wants to cry and say that they're sorry, you know?
Yeah.
I'm curious what your takeaway was from it.
I think I have the opinion no one likes. I got the sense from watching her statement that she has had some level of awakening, that she did get brainwashed by Jody. And I don't say that to, you know, obviously she was threatening to cut off her kid's teddy bear's head before that, you know, like she was problematic long before Jody. But I do think Jody was able to co-opt these existing ideas she had about discipline and purity and child rearing. And I do think Jody turned Ruby into something much, much more evil than she was before. And it seemed to me, maybe I'm like being too optimistic or naive, and I think like any cynicism is like fully valid because like, yeah, nobody owes Ruby Frankie anything, you know, but it seemed to me like she had had an awakening recently that she had been brainwashed, and I'm sure there's like a lot more she still has to unlearn and undo if she ends up, I don't know, who knows what's possible in these people. I honestly don't know. But yeah, I guess I felt like her statement was genuine.
Really?
And I'm like, it doesn't really make anything better. You know, like you said, for the kids listening to that, it's like, I don't know, what's better or worse? Not apologizing at all.
Yeah, it's true. I hope so. I think you're speaking to something really interesting, which is the cult within a cult thing, right? Mm-hmm. And this was one of the themes that I wrote down that I wanted to talk about is how, in your opinion, how Mormon is all of this? I feel like I kind of have these two voices on my shoulder, you know, the theoretical devil and angel. And I always hear my mom's voice in my head. It's always my mom saying, these are just crazy people. They're going to find a way to be crazy. They're going to do these terrible things, whether or not they're Mormon, because my mom's very active Mormon. So in her mind, she just completely divorces the two. Mm. There's bad people and there's good people. And some of those bad people happen to be Mormon. And then on the other side of my shoulder, there's just such obvious connections to Mormon culture, to Mormon doctrine, to so many things Mormon. And I think it's really interesting to think about where on the scale this case fits in how Mormon it is and what things about it are Mormon. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what your thoughts would be on that, because I kind of find myself internally wrestling a little bit with, no, I do think obviously this is connected to Mormonism, but sometimes I wonder, is that maybe blown out of proportion? Is that maybe an exaggerated connection? I don't know.
Yeah, because it obviously is extreme, right? Like, no one is claiming that the LDS Church in 2024 like advocates for anything like that kind of child abuse. But it's also true that Jodi was able to co-opt, I feel like I keep using the word co-opt a lot in this episode, but to co-opt Mormon sexual shame, which isn't unique to Mormonism, but is like a strong feature of Mormonism. You know, it's kind of the thing the whole operation runs on. She was able to use purity culture and sexual shame to gain power over people. And also, you know, she was recommended by Mormon bishops. Like, she was endorsed by the system. So she's taking advantage of the system, both in terms of belief and the actual structure of the system. So I feel like you can't divorce it from Mormonism. Like, again, obviously prophets and apostles don't get up at conference and advocate for stuff like that. But they do advocate for, you know, at 8, children become capable of sin, and we need to be excessively concerned about our children's purity and their sexual habits. And it's maybe got better over the years, but like, typically in Mormonism, there's just been like insane demonization of normal sexual development. Even just like the idea that you have to, you know, that it's like loving to wrangle a child. Like, it's so important that your child is pure and not sinful that the ends kind of justify the means. And again, it's not that anyone's saying that the church advocates for these means, but it's like, it's coming from somewhere, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, there's a reason Ruby had those kind of mindsets around discipline before she met Jodi, but Jodi could then take advantage of, like, her taking her son, 17-year-old son's bedroom away for 7 months. I feel like that's a very Mormon thing, like getting your door taken off your bedroom because like privacy is earned. And
totally,
I do think there's a lot of teachings in Mormonism that lend themselves to kids not being able to healthily individuate at an appropriate level for their age. So
absolutely,
to me, you just can't divorce Mormonism from all of it. And that's not to say that, you know, Russell M. Nelson is responsible for what Jodi Hildebrand and Ruby Frankie did to these children. But it's like, you literally cannot analyze anything without looking at the systems that created it. So
absolutely. Yeah. I agree. I think it would be remiss to completely remove the Mormonism. I think of it a lot as fuel to the fire, and potentially even worse, as a catalyst sometimes for this type of behavior, where, you know, maybe someone like Jodi, someone like Ruby, they might have these tendencies to control, but they are getting a lot of fuel to that fire. They're getting a lot of justification. Yeah. And perhaps to your point, they're also feel like they can assimilate even into society, even though they're doing these kind of extreme things, but it feels like they're able to make connections enough to what's being taught at Mormon church any Mormon church on any Sunday, that it becomes easier to justify deeply problematic behaviors because it's not coming from a vacuum, right? They can trace it back to things that they believe are true word of God itself.
And it's also like people like Ruby and Jody do exist outside of Mormonism, and like those tendencies can exist in humans outside of Mormonism, obviously. But it's like Ruby and Jody, we can't really say, oh, maybe they would have done that without Mormon, because there is no Ruby and Jody that without Mormonism, because they were raised Mormon and that, like, that's what they were formed in. So it's kind of not even real to say, oh, maybe they would have done this regardless. It's like, yeah, people do things like that outside of Mormonism, but, you know, Ruby's beliefs about children and purity and discipline and all that were informed by Mormonism, so are Jody's, you know.
Absolutely.
The Satan of it all.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, it's not the first time we've seen a Mormon case like this where the parents have got it into their minds that their kids have been possessed by Satan, essentially. I just don't think a belief in Satan is healthy or useful in any way.
Amen.
And it, again, like in any belief system, there's always going to be people that take it to the extreme. I don't know, for leaders and members of that system to not be aware of that is just naive. And I know that it comes from a place of like, well, we would never do that to children, and obviously, right? But
yeah, they don't want to relate to it in any way. And I think maybe even some of my pushback sometimes on, oh, this is so Mormon, is I feel even defensive of my former Mormon self and thinking, well, this is obviously an outlier. But I do think, I was even reflecting on this the other day, how in Mormon theology right now, this very second, even though I have a wonderful relationship with my Mormon family, they still, and I don't know if they think this literally, but they are still being taught that people like me have been led astray by the devil.
Yeah.
They still believe.
This abstract imaginary thing that you can kind of apply anything to because it's abstract and imaginary.
Yeah. And that's really scary. Yeah. It's really scary to feel like, and like I said, I don't know how much this applies to me personally because I'm not sure how literally the believing members around me interpret that, but I do know that they are hearing from the pulpit, from the highest leaders, that people like me have been led astray by an evil force. And you think, okay, there's that, which is scary in and of itself, and how quickly that could potentially spiral into young, objectively innocent children are being led astray by a devil into being possessed by Satan himself. There's these roots. And I also think that something about these cases, which I think is why us ex-Mormons are so fascinated by them, is that they are representing on a really magnified scale these things that we feel in the subtleties.
Yeah, like this is an extreme case of dehumanization of these kids, but as you're pointing out, a belief in Satan or in this good versus evil purity paradigm constantly creates like a lesser degree of dehumanization all the time. Like even you, someone who's like objectively lovely and doesn't seem like, I guess you're controversial because you talk negatively about the church, but like nothing about the way you live your life.
I don't seem should satanic be worthy, to you.
No.
Thank you.
Should be worthy of dehumanization. But even someone like you, in the minds of probably also really lovely, good people, you know, there's a degree to which they can't like fully see you in your humanity because it's too threatening to their belief system. So it's like everything that is extreme in the Jody Hildebrandt Ruby Frankie case, there's just like a whole spectrum of it, you know, that's playing out all the time.
Absolutely.
And again, we can say that it's not like anyone's trying to say like it's a uniquely Mormon problem, but I do think it, you know, it does kind of speak to what's problematic about Christianity as a whole, you know, this like good versus evil and Satan and, you know,
yeah,
all of that.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the purity culture, because I had this kind of light bulb moment that I've been excited to share with you, because I was listening to you and Tanner, because you did a YouTube video about this when everything was coming to light. And I actually just interviewed a sex therapist for Girls Camp.
Was it Natasha?
Amy Heffernan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's actually close with Natasha. She's fantastic. And she said, I asked her at the beginning of the episode, what do you think is the most problematic teaching about sex in Mormonism? And she said, I can point exactly to what it is. It's in Mosiah. It is that the natural man is an enemy to God.
Yes, exactly.
And when she told me that on the episode, and we talked a lot about it in terms of, you know, sex and sexual shame, but I was thinking about, as I was listening to you and Tanner talk last night, I kind of had this connection point where I realized that the natural man, because Jody Hildebrandt was so obsessed with purity, especially sexual purity, how connected that is to the natural man is an enemy to God. Mm-hmm. Deep down, we are enemies to God at our truest, most natural form. Mm. And how easy it would be if you believed that about sexual purity to then look at an innocent child and say, you are at your core a natural person. And that is objectively an enemy to God. Mm-hmm. And I kind of connected these dots of how intensely focused Jody's work was on sexual purity and how that spiraled into kids are inherently evil.
Yeah.
And I think it can, in a huge way, be traced back to that doctrine, which I would say is a pretty core Mormon belief.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. And like just sinfulness as kind of a fundamental premise of your worldview, you know, like without God, we are all sinful, which is, I mean, kind of just a Christian doctrine as a whole, I would say. Children are the most, like, the least encumbered by conditioning and the most free and in their natural state, which to a healthy person is something to celebrate and love and delight in. But if you're in a culture that, you know, is excessively all about the conditioning and the, you know, discipline and being forced into these boxes, then it makes sense to me that children could easily become like a warped focus the way they did here. Even just the way that Mormonism kind of teaches people to sort of reject their own inner children, you know, like to sort of clamp down on their own playfulness and free-spiritedness. And like, I think it's, was it Jesus who said like, look at the little children and like, was that Jesus?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. I'm like, yeah, he's right about that. Like there are so many things about like, become like a little child.
Yes.
I don't know if that's Mormon
that
or Christian.
Yes.
Okay. Good one. So I'm like, yeah, that's true. There's so much about like they have a beginner's mindset. They're usually very curious and non-judgmental and playful and creative and all those things are like beautiful. But if you're someone in a culture that is just like repression, 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 constantly be hyper-focused on your worthiness or perceived purity, then demonization of children.
Yeah, really scary.
This is chilling. I saw, this was like a fundamentalist pastor, like fundamentalist Christian pastor. I saw a tweet from this guy and it said, if you think 4-month-olds aren't capable of sin, you aren't truly reformed.
Oh, four-month-old?
And I was like, holy, and I just read a book about this basically Christian cult called The Assembly. And in The Assembly, from 6 months old, babies are hit, like spanked with a wooden spoon painfully because they believe it's the same kind of thing that Jody Hildebrandt was all about. Like we need to immediately curtail their natural impulses, make them excessively obedient and loyal to what you say.
Yes.
So it's like obviously not happening in Mormonism, but I do think like the thread that connects them all is what you said, the natural man is an enemy to God.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking now of Shiny Happy People, the Duggar family.
Yeah.
Where they had manuals on, you put your baby on a blanket and if they go off the blanket, you hit them.
That was the same kind of the Assembly cult. I think they're pretty
similar. Yes, I think they are connected. Yes. Yeah. I remember being so struck by that. And I wonder too how much of that, and this obviously is a sweeping statement. I'm not saying all big families are this way. I also wonder sometimes when parents are having so many children, and I mean, 6 by Mormon standards is not that many for, you know, in Ruby's case. But I also think, I mean, I have 2 children right now and there's only so much parent to go around. There's only so much emotional bandwidth to parent. And I think sometimes these parents have so many children that in order to keep things together, they resort to these really extreme methods because they literally cannot handle kids being kids.
Yeah.
Especially when you're looking at someone like Ruby, who is putting her life online, who is showcasing, this is my beautiful family and look how wonderful my children are and how well behaved. You can see how you would start to maybe resort to more extreme measures of discipline in order just to keep that together.
Yeah, because you probably just don't have the bandwidth. That was what was so sad to me about Shiny Happy People. Every at least televised example we've had of these giant families, it's come out later that the tactics they had to use to kind of keep everything together were brutal and, you know, like antithetical to a child's health, which does make sense because you're not really going to have the bandwidth to support every child being their most sort of creative, explorative, you know, not that I'm advocating for like a discipline-free parenting, that's, you know, you got to put limits on kids to keep them safe. But like when you have to run to such a tight ship because there's so many people, there's way less space for that kind of...
Exactly. Yeah. For just, I think, normal childhood development.
Yeah.
Do you know of Dr. Becky? Have you heard of her? Mm-hmm. She's wonderful. She has a book called Good Inside, and I've talked about this on the podcast. I'm fairly parenting advice book averse, especially just because I oftentimes find it more overwhelming than helpful. But I really love Dr. Becky, and her whole premise is that children are fundamentally good. We're all fundamentally good. Mm-hmm. And if an adult makes a mistake, you don't think, oh, they're a bad person. You think, oh, they just did a bad thing. And her whole point is that children are good inside, and that when they have these problematic behaviors, those are usually them trying to tell you something or a symptom of something they're going through. And I love that approach so much because I think it has been so revelatory for me growing up as a Mormon person. And even though I think my parents did a fairly good job of instilling some of that, I just think it's literally the opposite of natural man. It's actually, you're really good, and children especially are so good inside, but children do sometimes objectively terrible things, right? And that's part of being a human being, and that's part of developing. And I just think, again, how absolutely sad it is that kids in these cultures and in these situations don't have the opportunity just to be. And I also think, again, how difficult it is as a mother of two to foster the appropriate space for my children to have their tantrums and to be able to hold them and to be able to give them that space to be a toddler. Like I said, I just don't know how you could do that for so many kids all at once, unless you're incredibly well resourced.
Yeah.
And that's why I always think with, you know, these larger families, you also get over-parentification of the older kids.
Yes.
And they have to start taking care of their younger siblings. Mm-hmm. There's just so many dynamics there that I think are quite toxic and really saddening for the children who just deserve to be kids.
Yeah. And I could imagine if you have more kids than you can realistically handle, you're probably more likely to be drawn to ideologies that make the child the problem and kind of validate your sort of like blind rage about it or frustration in a way that doesn't require you to actually sit with the responsibility you have of, like, you chose to have that many children and you now have to show up for them appropriately. It's probably quite, you know, I could imagine it being appealing, the idea that, oh, well, those children are just bad and they're just choosing to be bad, and I just need to be more and more and more strict. Because being strict and cold and heartless is, for some people, probably easier. Yeah, I mean,
absolutely.
You know what I mean? It's an easier path than...
Yes, and you might get better, quote, results, aka children who are intimidated into behaving the way that you want them to.
Oh, which is another Mormon piece of this, is just the idea that you should mold your children into something very specific. You have a set outcome that you're trying to achieve. It's not just like, let's see who this human being turns into.
Yeah.
You know, within good ethical boundaries. It's like they need to turn into a Mormon missionary, and, you know, they need to turn into all these very Mormon things.
Yeah.
And if they don't, Satan's got them and you failed. And so anything justifies making sure they become that.
Yes. I wanted to talk about that because I think that's something that's come up big time for me with the Ruby Frankie stuff. This justification of suffering in order to reach a greater goal.
God, that's so Mormon as well. Just like suffering is inherently noble for some reason.
And suffering gets us to the ultimate reward. You know, I think about this with LGBTQ individuals. Okay, you're gay. You're going to probably suffer pretty significantly to live a celibate life here on Earth, but it'll be worth it because ultimate joy awaits you. And I think this happened on such a, you know, intense, concentrated scale where Jody was literally saying things like, people don't understand, I'm just doing this for my kids. There's a soundbite of her, I believe it was on her YouTube channel, and she says, if your kid caught fire, you would grab a blanket and you would stamp that fire out. Yeah. And you wouldn't be really worried, she was kind of insinuating, about being gentle with your child because they're on fire. So you're going to like do what you have to do to get the fire out. Mm. She was using that as an analogy for how she parented, basically saying, oh, this might seem like I'm stamping my kids out, but they're on fire. Mm. And this is so urgent that I have to use these type of techniques in order to save them. It's out of love. In fact, it's out of the most love.
Yeah.
Kind of like, I'm willing to hurt you because I love you. Mm. Ew, that just triggered something in my brain. I don't know if you remember this. The analogy in Mormonism about pruning, there's a talk about a bush and the gardener goes to prune the bush and the bush is like crying and says like, why are you hurting me? And the gardener says, it's to help you grow and become what you're ultimately meant to become. That's pretty icky. That can justify some really terrible things, especially if you think that there's someone in charge of maybe putting you through a certain amount of suffering in order to get, quote, where you need to go.
Yeah, I mean, Mormon God is a pretty brutal parent, pretty judgmental and willing to punish. So that's kind of a small leap. Also, I feel like it's very Mormon to, I think this is so core to Mormonism, is creating this abstract concept of love that isn't actually aligned with the felt experience of love in the body. Like when you feel true love in the body, this is something we talk about all the time on our channel, there's a natural sense of like interconnectedness you feel with, you know, other sentient life and other people. There's a natural unifying effect that it has, and it lowers your fear and all that. But Mormonism, and like a lot of religions, it will talk a lot of love, but it's really just an abstract concept. And that's what allows them to, you know, like promote homophobia as loving, because it's like God doesn't support gay marriage. So it wouldn't be loving for us to give gay people. It's actually more loving to be homophobic. It's more loving, you know, the Ruby Fire and all. I mean, that's what's happened here, right? Like they've even in Jody's like completely not remorseful statement at the hearing, she said, I love these kids so much. And maybe she believes that she does, because what love is to her has just been so abstractified as to be completely divorced from what love actually feels like, which I feel like happens a lot in Mormonism.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. And that creates so much shame.
Yeah.
Because you're being told this is love. This is God's love. Mm. And then you feel shame when you don't feel that, like you said. And then you in your own brain have to make these leaps and do these mental gymnastics to say, okay, I guess this is love. And I think anyone who has left Mormonism or other similar high demand religions has had to reckon with that. I had my friend, I told you I have a best friend, Tanner, and I had him on for an episode recently because he came out as gay. He left the church and I stayed in the church. And we had a falling out over it because basically he was saying the church is a cult and it's hateful towards people like me, and I didn't want to hear it, and we parted ways, and luckily we've reconciled. But I'm thinking about what you just said and how really true and tangible that felt to me, a feeling like I love Tanner, but this church is telling me that true love is following God and believing this thing and staying true to this thing, but that didn't feel like love for Tanner. And it was causing me so much inner turmoil. Also, David Archuleta released his song today. Have you listened to it?
I haven't listened to it yet.
Oh, it's so, so good. It's about his mom. And he called his mom one day and said he was leaving the church. And she said, I'm going to leave too. And she said to him, if we go to hell, we'll go to hell together. Chills.
Oh.
The song is so, so beautiful. It's so poignant because I think it's an example of what you said. I think it's an example of such a clear moment for a mother of realizing, I've been told one thing is love, but it's not really, you know, like this is love to stand by my child. And love doesn't make sense if there's a heaven in which my child doesn't get to be there because of who they are.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'd never crystallized it that way, but I think that that's something that I've felt on such a real level. And again, can snowball into something really, really terrible.
it's just so fundamentally messed up that you're, as a Mormon child, you're taught that God loves us so much, and then that is immediately coupled with, and you won't get to be with your family forever if you don't please him, and you have to worship him all the time in the specific ways that he asks you to through these men. Or, you know what I mean? It's like you're, as soon as you're born into a Mormon family, you're being, at least ideologically, being sold a form of love that is not real. That is not real love. And you might be lucky and grow up in a Mormon family where there is like a very like felt sense of love despite Mormon teachings. And I think that's what will make people defensive, because a lot of people would say, well, you know, like I was very loved as a child. And obviously it's a spectrum. But I do think that Mormonism, any like high control group that has us versus them thinking, by design is like limiting love.
Yeah.
Because it has to like excessively catch, like any categorization of people into good and bad, like what you said about how all humans are just kind of good, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we could have caveats, you know, we don't have to into it, but like I think that's so true. Like that's become so core to my worldview since leaving Mormonism. And I feel like if you would have asked me when I was in Mormonism, you know, is this a religion of love, I would have said yes, absolutely, because I was finding a sense of like safety and belonging and connection to others that all do resemble love, you know. It kind of goes in and out, but then it's coupled with this complete bastardization of love. And then it's also, you know, I like became homophobic when I joined Mormonism, when I wasn't before. So there were ways it actively reduced my lovingness.
Absolutely. I'm thinking of, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. I mean, that's the crux of Christianity, is a God who loved enough that he sacrificed in a very brutal, gruesome way, his son. And
it's like, why did he have to sacrifice? Because we're all just so inherently bad.
Exactly.
Why did he make us to be inherently bad?
Exactly. And then have to kill his own child in order to make up for our badness. It just is on so many levels deeply ingrained. And yeah, I mean, Ruby was quoted as saying, "My children are full of evil." Like, really taking that to heart. These kids are evil, and it is my job to root that evil out at any cost. And then she has them standing in the sun for 12 hours in St. George, like jumping on a tramp.
Yeah.
You know, burning their feet. It's just, to her, and, you know, maybe to your point about when she made the statement, maybe there was some true regret there, because she had this belief that she had to help her kids be better. And then Jody came in and really magnified that into, no, your kids are evil. And at all costs, you got to do what you can do to root out the evil.
And it's like, yeah, child abuse happens in non-religious people, obviously. But in this situation, Jody was able to co-opt an existing religious belief that was there. Like, to the average, sane, healthy, secular person who doesn't have, I mean, maybe we all have some degree of a magical worldview, but doesn't have that like installed magical worldview, it's going to be a lot hard to convince them that their kids are evil and possessed by demons, because they're just kids, right?
Exactly.
Like, modern psychology has always been like so far beyond the way that the LDS church is teaching people to raise their kids.
Yeah, absolutely. If there's something to grasp onto, it's going to be an easier sell ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was many things about Ruby that made that an easier sell, because there was those beliefs there already. It seems like there was this intense need to be perfect. One of the themes that has really stood out to me about this case too is, in the documentary, they mentioned many times that Ruby said, oh, actually, I don't think this was in the documentary. I think this was in a podcast I was listening to, but Ruby liked to talk about motherhood is powerful. Motherhood is powerful. She said that a lot. And that sparked for me the Mormon belief of honor thy father and mother, and how also twisted very quickly that can become when honor thy father and mother becomes about complete obedience to whatever a parent says, and how that even leaks into adulthood, where I talk all the time to grown adults who say, I cannot leave the church because of what it would do to my parents. And that to me is honor thy father and mother at its very worst. It's a grown adult saying, I'm going to pretend and live inauthentically because it's what I need to do in order to honor my parents and even to love my parents. And I think that that's another theme that I kind of connected happening on this really intense level, being used as control and discipline in Ruby's case, but I also see happening in a much more subtle way all the time in the ex-Mormon space.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you obviously you're supposed to be codependent with your parents as kids, but then there's so many ex-Mormon grown adults who have this level of enmeshment with their parents to where, yeah, they literally think it's their job to pretend, because pretending is more loving than, you know, that basically just that they're responsible for their parents' feelings, even as adults.
Yeah.
It's tough.
It is tough. And I think there's also a little bit of that I was thinking about, where there's this kind of cyclical thing that happens where adults take care of their kids a certain way because their parents are watching mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. And I think this happens a lot with Mormonism as well. I remember when I told my mom I left the church, I knew that she would feel a lot of shame from her parents because of my decisions. Mm. And how sad that is, right? Because my mom was willing to say, you're a grown adult and you're making your own decisions and I respect you, but she didn't know if she would get that same thing from her parents. And therefore, you know, a lot of parents don't behave the way my mom did because they're so worried about the shame because they want to do right by their parents that then they just continue passing that along.
Oh, yeah, it's such a burden to put on kids. It also reminds me of, well, on our channel, we've just been doing a lot of like evangelical Christian content. Mm. And how, and this happens in Mormonism too, but in these purity cultures, marriage, and specifically like quite quick young marriage, is like put on this pedestal. And then the justification is, well, this Christian marriage is so superior that it kind of justifies all of like the, you know, the rushing into it, or maybe they won't call it that because God is giving them a witness. But this type of marriage has not really ever worked for people. Like, these young, you know, fundamentalist Christians right now, it's not like their parents had these healthy, amazing marriages. It's not like their grandparents did. But every generation is continuing to pass on this false belief that they have lived out. And on some level, no is false because it didn't work for them. But there's too much shame reckoning with the fact that maybe just the ideology is bad. They're continuing to peddle a lie to their own children. Like, people are being lied to by their elders because their elders are still upholding that type of marriage. Yeah. Maybe is this too much of a tangent?
No.
I don't know.
No, that's absolutely making sense to me.
But just the way that, like, entire generations will still peddle the lies because there's, like, no space for them to separate from their communities ideologically. Oh, it's just a shit show.
No, absolutely. I'm thinking, too, about, with that lie, how people will still believe in that and then think that they are the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's something that I think also any person in a fundamental religion has felt, where you feel like, oh, this doesn't feel like it's working, so I must be wrong. I must be broken. There must be something inherently wrong with me if this is just like not working for me, because it's easier to think there's something wrong with you in a lot of ways than to think there's something wrong with this thing that everybody around you is believing and upholding and perpetuating. Mm. And I think that that causes, again, just lots of shame because, you know, young people get married and then it doesn't work. They get divorced and it's like, well, I must have done something wrong. I must have not followed the formula well enough, when in reality, the problem is the formula itself.
You know, in the 2020 documentary, they talked about how, I think it was one of the police officers, said they had no reason to believe that this wouldn't have ultimately resulted in the death of these children if R hadn't escaped and this had all come to light. And I think that is so horrifying to think about, because Jody and Ruby were so convinced of their ideology around discipline and children being good or evil and all that stuff, that Ruby didn't start out doing stuff like this. Like, there was this gradual increase of abuse, because at no point could they question the ideology behind what they were doing. So they just kept doubling down. And so it's becoming more and more and more harmful. And you see that all the time in religions. Like, how many times when you were Mormon, were you like not doing well? So you're like, I'm going to double down in this in some way.
Yeah.
Which is really just making you have more scrupulosity and like become more unhealthy. But
oh, so true.
That's like standard practice in a high control group.
Yeah, so true. Because she's using these very heavy-handed discipline techniques, probably borderline abuse, the things she's showing on her channel, withholding food, taking away a bed. And her kids were probably not getting better, you know, according to her. And so it probably felt more justifiable to continue doing more and more and taking more and more extreme measures than to take a step back and be like, maybe I'm just seeing this all wrong. Mm-hmm. Maybe I just fundamentally am seeing this wrong. Yeah. And instead you can double down until forever, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's something that is also a brain pattern, you know, when people are in faith crisis. I think we oftentimes can see that. And I saw that in myself where it's like, okay, I'm having a crisis of faith. It's because I'm not reading my Book of Mormon. So I'm going to read my Book of Mormon even more. And I'm going to go to church even more and participate even more because you're feeling dissonance and it causes you potentially to become more extremely involved because you feel like that's what you have to do.
Yeah, like you're never more faithful than when you're doubting your faith.
Exactly.
Seems to be the case.
Exactly. And there's a lot of messaging that's been really ingrained that's what you have to do.
Also, Mormonism really encourages certainty. Like it puts certainty on a pedestal. And so I'm sure Ruby is coming to adopt this ideology that Jody's instilling in her, probably through having similar types of emotional experiences that confirm her testimony of Mormonism's truthfulness. Mm. It was easier for her to keep believing that her children were more and more and more evil than it was to question her ideology.
Yeah.
Because once that certainty is in place, again, people can be like rigid in their beliefs in and out of Mormonism, obviously, but it's like high control groups do encourage rigid thinking. And so, where maybe a normal parent who like fell into hyper disciplinary tactics might be able to at some point take a step back and be like, whoa, what have I fallen into? It makes sense that there would be like less likelihood. Maybe,
absolutely. And I think just one of the biggest, maybe more obvious overarching themes is just if you have been taught your whole life. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call Mormonism extreme, but if you are used to...
Would you not?
yes. Okay, I can.
Like, I grew up in Provo. It was very chill.
If you can grow up your whole life believing something extreme and believing it with all your heart, of course you're going to be more susceptible to believing the next extreme thing to come your way. You just are going to, because you're used to thinking that way. Mm-hmm. You're used to thinking, to believing extreme things. I even recognize that in myself to this day, where I find myself, this is such a random tangent, but Andrew Huberman has just been called out for, have you seen the article?
No, I recently got called out in the Andrew Huberman comment section on Instagram, because this is just a stupid side note, because he said he was doing an episode on peptides. And I was like, a man who doesn't use sunscreen is going to teach us about peptides, lol. Just like a little joke for the sunscreen girlies. They were not in the chat. And it was just all these men piling on. Anyway,
you were ahead of the curve, because he's just been called out essentially for sharing a lot of information that's not very sound.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he's quite, he's not as like bulletproof as we've all like to think.
Exactly.
And it's like, obviously Stanford neuroscientist, very bright, but
but still
it's become a bit of a cult. Like,
as I was reading that, and I don't even really listen all that much to Andrew Huberman. I'll tune in here and there.
Yeah, me too.
But as I was reading this article, I realized I never even thought to question the veracity of the information he's sharing. I heard he was a Stanford professor and was like, cool.
Yeah.
If someone has this large of a platform, they probably know what they're talking about. And I realized in myself a tendency sometimes to still react that way to certain authority figures because that's how I've been my whole life. You know, it took me until I was 22 years old, as I think a fairly bright individual, to question the authority of the Mormon prophet. And I think that feels kind of crazy in retrospect, but that was my world and my reality. And so you know, how do you even know to question your own reality? And I think we do have a predisposition as Mormons who have bought so deeply into Mormonism to fall into those things. So you and Tanner talked about this on your YouTube video about it, but just these cults within cults, because who better to draw into a cult than someone in a bigger umbrella of a cult, you know? Mm-hmm. The last thing I want to talk about is the influencer vlogger of it all. Mm-hmm. The thing that I was thinking is, I think the church, I'm sure you could find like concrete evidence for this, but I would venture to say, and I think that this is not a reach, the church is really stoked when there's these Mormon families who are showing their lives on the internet because they're hugely popular. I think the heyday has kind of passed, which is what I want to talk about. But I think that you could say the church is like, oh, great, we have all these ambassadors for Mormonism online. And when Mormonism comes up and some person who's disconnected from it says, well, I think, isn't Mormonism kind of culty? Oh, no, I follow Ruby Frankie and look how sweet her kids are. And she seems like such a good mom, right? So you kind of have these people who are putting a face to Mormonism, who are conventionally attractive and have these beautiful homes. And that worked, I think, quite well. And it's interesting with this Ruby thing, because obviously that backfired hugely. This has been terrible press for the church.
Yeah.
But I've also been thinking that I think that heyday of Mormon influencer has kind of passed. Mm. And I've been thinking about how that's maybe happening on a larger scale, where even people who, you know, family vloggers who are not abusive or any of these terrible things, a lot of them are just simply leaving the church or they're not wearing garments anymore, or they're having public faith crises and transitions. And I've just been thinking about how interesting that is from this perspective of the church was getting all of this free advertising and how much that seems to be backfiring. And maybe that's a bias, because I'm sure there's still plenty of active, alive and well Mormon family vloggers and influencers. But I do know for a fact that it is becoming far less popular to be able to even admit that. And even people who are probably still active Mormon on the internet are not talking about it because of how, because of the general feeling right now towards Mormonism.
Yeah. The church like had that mindset when, well, it, the church has always had this mindset that as society advances, as technology advances, we'll just have more ability to share the gospel. And if we have more ability to share the gospel, then obviously more and more people will become Mormon. And the prophecies are all that the church should be booming right now. There are actively prophecies not panning out for them right now, which they have their own ways of dealing with. But they're not realizing that, like, what is most interesting to outsiders is not going to be, oh, we believe in a savior. It's like, yeah, tons of people in America believe we have a savior and it's Jesus Christ. Like, that's not really as special as you think.
Yeah.
It's all the other stuff. Like, it's the stuff that makes you a peculiar people that is actually deeply fucked up. Like, it's just time and time again, the church is like so blind to how people having more access to information is like not going to work in their favor.
Absolutely.
Which is, I love to see. It's beautiful.
I know.
I'm so proud.
I know. Honestly, and I even think of just, yeah, obviously the power of the internet toward helping people rethink things and just exposing them to more ideas. And I think influencers objectively hold influence. They have a lot of power. And I mean, especially doing girls camp, I've talked to so many influencers. I've been kind of privy to the influence that they have by interviewing them. Mm. And it's an immense influence. And to see primarily these women who came up on the internet and had these deep Mormon connections to now come out and say, no, I'm no longer doing that.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge deal. I think it's a bigger deal than we realize that it is.
Yes.
Because I think it has shifted the general feeling on the internet towards Mormonism. Like, I don't feel like you see very often anymore people influencing Mormonism. And if they do, you know what the comment section is going to be.
Yeah.
It's going to be bad.
Yeah.
Almost always. Like, it'll show up on my For You page and I'll look, and it's usually quite bad because there's enough going on that people are not really buying what these people are selling anymore. And just thinking about, yeah, the perspective of the powers that be at the church kind of watching that all happen and how truly detrimental I think that's been, just even to the brand of Mormonism.
Yeah. It's like the more light has been shed on Mormonism, the worse it's got for them. Like, they were able to do well, you know, when people were still just in the dark about them and they were just kind of this weird people nobody knew anything about. But yeah, now it's like the average outsider knows more about Mormonism than a lot of believing members, because obviously they have to filter everything through such a warped lens.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so true. That's really interesting how striking that even was for me in leaving, of discovering there's some pretty available information about my own religion that I did not know.
Yeah.
You know, even as a human in 2020 with the internet and all these things. Yeah. And I think the Ruby Frankie case, I mean, not to say at all, I hope this would go without saying, that like, oh good, because this is bad press for Mormonism. It's just such a horrible thing.
Right.
But I think on a more general level, with this wave of primarily women and mothers promoting the Mormon faith and how good it was for their families, that's backfiring in a big, big way. And we're seeing the toxic side of all of that too, where even if it wasn't to the extent of what Ruby did to her children, I think it's also kind of shed light on, actually, a lot of this can lead very quickly to toxic family situations. Same with shiny, happy people. Mm. You know, it's broader than Mormonism too, but shiny, happy people, they had a TLC show. I loved it. I ate that shit up growing up. I mean, I was Mormon then, but then you see, oh, there's this underside that now those are the stories people are more interested in than the facade stuff.
Yeah. Cause we did generations of facade content. And so I just feel like every generation wears less of a mask, or maybe it's just a different type of mask, but it does just feel, you know, when sometimes if you watch old movies, you're like, at no point did humans ever act or speak like this. But at the time, people would consume this content and it would do something for them. Mm-hmm. And now we just can't relate to it at all, because I do feel like, I mean, Mormonism being a good example, every generation you go back, people wore a thicker mask and people like let less humanity in, or like allowed for less like real humanness. I don't know.
Yeah, totally. Totally, totally. Thank you so much. I love hearing your thoughts on this. And I think it's really valuable, you know, circling back to that first question about the Mormonism of it all. I think it's super valuable to take a look at these cases that are so shocking and so extreme and say, but what does this say about things that we are interacting with? And not even just Mormonism, but I think that they provide opportunities, hopefully, for reflection and hopefully for improvement and progress. Mm-hmm. And that's why I felt really drawn to having a conversation about this, because I do think there's just so much about Ruby Frankie and Jody Hildebrandt that just connected in so many different ways to Mormonism and even to life outside of Mormonism. And so I really appreciate you helping me unpack all of that.
Yeah, it's honestly an honor to be here.
I'm so glad you're here. I hope that we can chat again soon on the podcast and off the podcast.
I want you to come on our channel and react to cringy Mormon messages with us.
I would love literally something a bit lighter. Yes, sign me up. We'll go have some fun and chuckles over there. But thank you so much again. Can you just say one more time where people can find you?
Yes, Zelf on the Shelf everywhere. So awesome. YouTube, TikTok, Instagram.
You're smart for that. Mine are all different. I mean, like, YouTube and Instagram are the same, but TikTok's different. And anyway, nice.
That's okay.
I'm sure Zelf on the Shelf was not probably hard to capture that very unique handle.
It was a good brand,
yeah. Yeah, very smart branding. Thank you so much, Sam. It was so wonderful to talk to you. And thank you to everybody for listening. We'll see you next Wednesday. Bye. Cheese.